Hey friends, we wanted to take a quick minute and personally invite you to two really special gatherings coming this fall. First, our intentional motherhood retreat in Portland, Oregon, October 15th through the 17th, and then our intentional fatherhood retreat in Austin, Texas, November 12th through the 14th. Honestly, these retreats have become so much more than events for us. They've become spaces where people encounter God, experience healing, honesty, friendship, freedom, and real transformation. We live in a world that is full of information. We have podcasts, books, content, advice, but transformation requires more than information. Sometimes you need space, you need community, you need honesty, you need the presence of God, and you need to get around other people who are fighting for the same things you are. At these events, we've watched marriages soften again. We've watched fathers come out of hiding. We've watched mothers breathe deeply again. We've watched people feel seen, known, challenged, and deeply encouraged. And we would genuinely love for you to join us. You can learn more and grab tickets at intentionalparents.org. And for all things fatherhood, you can visit intentionalfatherhood.org. We hope to see you there. You're listening to the Intentional Parents Podcast, brought to you by Intentional. Intentional is all about spiritual formation in the family. We desire to bring biblical hope and practical help. Enjoy this week's conversation. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Intentional Parents Podcast. Today, purity culture, the history, the harm, and the hope. This has been something that has been, man, on our minds, on our hearts, on our to-do list, on our team's list, on people's list of what they've asked us to talk about. And it's a tricky one. It's an exciting one. And if you even understand those two words, purity culture, you either know or you don't know. And so if you don't know, hang around. We're going to talk to you about what it is, why it matters, how it's impacted you potentially or your kids, depending on your age and stage. And then also what harm it might have caused. But I also want to just let you know right off the bat, this is not going to just be bashing, or we won't bash in general anyway, but we're not just going to talk negatively about it. We want to give you what happened, why it happened, and we ultimately want to give you hope. So that's where we're going today. I have the loveliest of ladies with me, Elizabeth and Diane. So glad you're here to talk about this.
It's so good to be here. I'm excited about this because we have been talking about it for a long time.
Yeah, long time.
And like now we're finally drumming up the courage to dive in.
That's a good way to say it. And also, just as you all know, just as a reminder, YouTube, watch us on YouTube. We're in our new studio space. It's been a gift. So fun. Just a couple of business items. YouTube, check that out. Those who've rated and subscribed and then left a comment has been so helpful. And we are a part, as you know, of the algorithm. One of the ways to say thank you if this has been helpful is just please do that. It's such a gift. And want to also say, if you haven't signed up for our motherhood retreat or our fatherhood retreat coming this fall, do that. Pause. And man, what a great thing for us to be able to meet up. So just remember those things are happening. You can go to our website. Details will be in show notes. But let's talk about purity culture. Let's start with the history. This started somewhere. Elizabeth and I grew up in it. Diane, you and Phil, in one way or another, and this is the most kind thing, but I would say lived in some of it, promoted some of it, but not in a sense of harm, but in a sense of like,
no, but
there's a lot of beauty in the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were definitely complicit in it. Yeah. I mean, I'll speak for myself.
Yeah.
Some of the things we're going to talk about today, I think, oh, I did that. I said that. So this comes in, you know, I talk about humility sometimes. How important it is as we get older that this becomes something we put on. The Bible talks in Colossians about putting on things, putting on compassion. It doesn't mean you feel it. Doesn't mean you're not resistant to it, but a purposeful thing. So I think as we talk about purity culture, I like that two generations are talking about it because it was well intended and it did harm.
I want to say thank you, though, for your humility, because this would not be happening. And this is, I think, the model that you and Phil do so well at. The parents, even the adult parents of the adult children, have to invite that. The adult children can't force that. Although we're excited and eager to jump onto the conversation and say, yes, thank you, that is so helpful. Adult parents have to go first. They have to continue to set that table even in older age and stages.
And we have to have that courage. And it really helps that you are both so responsive and gentle. And you've put on compassion when I put on humility. Mm. And of course, that makes it so much easier to do that. But if you are listening and you were part of the purity culture, if you were one of the ones who received that and it did some harm to you, or you think it may have done some harm to you, I would just encourage you to invite your parents to listen into this podcast.
Yes.
So because Brooke and Elizabeth are going to be talking about their own experience, as well as the experience of others that we are hearing from. Mm. And your parents need to understand. They just need to understand. They need to feel your pain a little bit.
Yes. Well, I want to hear what you're going to say. I do want to just define really quick what it is. And then
what I was going to say. Let's define it, because I think there's, obviously there's some that the minute they hear the word, they just cringe, like, oh my gosh, like they've fully lived it and experienced it like we did.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe there's others where like they roughly know what it is. Yeah. They're not sure how much it affected them. I think a quick definition, and obviously you'll pick it up as the episode goes and we talk.
Yeah.
We're going to talk really in depth about it.
Well, we wrote this down. So I'm just actually going to read this, because I think this is much easier to read, because we want to be concise about this. Mm-hmm. And I want to also say that anybody that was like, that doesn't even know, that's listening to this, like, whoa, purity culture has had like maybe a dark underbelly that we didn't know. This is not to shame or highlight or call out anybody. This is to name what has happened, to name for some people, not everybody even, let's be fair. This has not harmed everybody, but it's harmed more than it hasn't in some senses. And I think to just pretend that certain things didn't happen, even though they were well-meaning things, is something we can learn from. And I think as parents, we have to remember, even if we are incredibly well-meaning and want to do the right things, like Diane, you're saying, to protect your kids, to set up the right place, you can still unintentionally cause harm, which doesn't feel fair. It feels like a broken thing this side of heaven, and it is. But we can either pretend that those things didn't happen, or we can own them and repair. And that's what this is about. This isn't about shaming anybody or shaming a movement or saying, oh my gosh, it was rooted in beautiful things. But purity culture, it was a movement that shaped America, specifically evangelical Christianity, in the 90s and early 2000s. We remember that was the height of. You had really big hair back then, Diane. I remember seeing photos.
Did.
I loved it. I loved the photos. And in many ways, it was sincere, but often fearful and overly corrective. And it was a reaction to the moral and cultural upheaval to many Christian parents that believed that had been marked by the 1960s and 70s, the sexual revolution, which we're going to talk about, rising divorce rates, the normalization of pornography. At that time, it was more in print, but it was also a much more normal thing during those times. You have AIDS, hookup culture, and then the broader sex, drugs, and rock and roll ethos that was really associated with baby boomers or Gen X. And that's where most parents of Elizabeth and I's age and stage were at when this came about. And so the parents of the church and the leaders who built purity culture were often those Gen X or boomers, and they wanted to really have purity instead of sexual chaos. They wanted to have life, and they wanted to not have their kids' marriage destroyed like maybe theirs was or others. And so that's kind of like the thing that this is. But let's talk about the history. What was kind of the cultural backdrop? And why I'm asking you, Diane, is because you grew up in this. Mm-hmm. Like, you were born in 1959. Mm-hmm. 59. Okay. I always think Phil's born in 55. He's born in 50.
50.
50. 50.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
Yes.
So legit.
Even more, he lived through it.
He lived through all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was
a young child, but.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was a terrifying time for Americans. Mm. We had the Vietnam War going on, which was just throwing our children, our men, into an unwinnable war. So we were appalled by it, which set off a whole frenzy of rebellion, I guess, in the college generation at the time. Usually it is the college age generation that really sets off movements and insists on change. And of course, it's rarely done well, but it's necessary. And so at that time, I remember watching on TV, black and white TV, they still didn't have color, women on TV undressing, taking off their bras and throwing them in the middle and burning their bras. And I remember as a little kid, I was probably really young, being just like appalled. Who does something like that? Why would they do something like that? I mean, I was still at the age where I couldn't wait to wear a bra, let alone throw one on a pile. There was just big displays of anger. And then there was also just this whole free love thing where people were just sleeping around. And that had probably been happening even in the 50s and since the beginning of time.
Yeah.
But it was advertised as something new and something good and something
became really normalized
to live up to. So now all of a sudden women were supposed to be doing this. And I do remember just thinking, this is frightening. This is scary. Now, I didn't grow up in a Christian home, so it wasn't until the mid-70s that I was part of a church at all. And church brought a sense of safety. We don't do this. There's rules.
That's so interesting, though, that you didn't grow up in a Christian home and still something intuitively in you was like, this doesn't sit right.
No, this is scary.
Yeah.
This is overturning something important.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, Phil was born in 1950. And so he was a teenager when this was going on. In 1968, when the riots were happening on college campuses, he was going to college.
He was an adult.
And he was scared. He was scared to go on campus. And he was very much caught up in this movement of you almost were just expected in a relationship that now you would also, if you were anything good and manly or womanly, you were going to have sex. I remember in my high school graduation, senior prom, I opted not to go. I was a new Christian at the time, but my friends were booking hotel rooms at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco with the expectation that if you went to the prom was expensive, the guy paid for it. If you went to the prom, you were going to have sex. And that was, for me, frightening. And but that was going on all around us. Also in the church, all of a sudden divorce was hitting the church. Whereas before, in evangelical Bible churches, we were safe from divorce because we had rules, we had standards. And I remember sitting in some of the early meetings, even later in the 80s, that were not nuancing divorce, that there is a time. There is a time where a divorce is a rescue from a really awful situation. But it was at that time labeled all bad. So there was all this fear. And then abortion became legalized. And so now we're, you know, being told that we're murdering babies. And it was just a revolutionary time.
Yeah.
And a frightening time for parents to be raising their children.
No kidding.
I'm just like, listen, I love history in general, but just I feel like the most honoring thing for any situation, family especially, is learning the history, whether that's of your family, of the moment and the decisions, because it does shape that moment. I mean, I cannot think. I mean, if parents, you guys know this, anyone listening, our kids are going to have so many things to say about the technology revolution and AI and how much you're like, man, my parents were crazy. I mean, and we're having these talks right now. We're like, yeah, son, you're not going to have ChatGPT on your phone. He's like, why? And I'm like, there's countless reasons, and I have good ones and I've given them to him. But like, and it's also like, I think this is best and I'm not going to risk, you know, your, wherever you're at in this situation or your potential development with this app, you know?
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of the same thing of like the parallels of so much of what we are carrying right now as parents with all that we're seeing with technology, and it's like this free for all, and so many parents just handing their kids a device, and you know, and we're taking the more extreme route. And I think it's so important to understand the history of things. If we're going to react and respond, if we're going to respond and not just react to something that happened that maybe had some harmful implications, we have to understand the context. Just like it's so easy for our generation to cancel their parents left and right and say, my parents are so unhealthy. They're so emotionally unhealthy. They need to go to therapy. Well, that may be very true. And I don't want to diminish the reality that that is so many's lived experience. But it's also helpful to understand the context in which your parents grew up, where they did not have access to what we have access to now. Therapy was not popular and normalized and strongly encouraged. In fact, it was the opposite. The crazy people went to therapy.
Exactly.
Like the literal crazy people. Yes. And so I just think it's so important that we start the way we just did with you explaining what was happening and the fear that was just kind of everywhere because things felt so out of control. And so really as a like response to that, as a how do we protect our kids from that, Purity Movement had all the means to flourish because it gave so many rules and a lot that felt like safety because it felt like control.
Yes. And it wasn't just the parents.
Yeah.
It was very much initiated by church leaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to understand your parents could have handled it very carefully. But you were still, if you were being raised in the church at the time, you couldn't not be affected by, even just a few minutes ago, Elizabeth and I talking about something I didn't know had happened in youth group that sounded appalling to me. I mean, your kids were being, you kids were being exposed to it from so many different angles.
Yeah.
And not with discernment.
It was an overreaction. The church was not wanting our kids to inherit chaos, which that makes sense because everything around was chaotic. And again, I think it makes sense. I do love all the ads coming out currently of like kids in the 1920s just chain smoking cigarettes. And someone had just said, there's social media like, you remember when we said that that was like no one had a problem with this? There was just kids walking around everywhere just smoking packs and packs of cigarettes. We just didn't know. And honestly, they were just relating it to like kids having phones in their pockets. And and I don't think that's far off at all. And in many ways, I think phones are far more damaging because of the psychological damage that they do. But regardless of that, I think it is understandable when you feel out of control. And I don't mean this is an excuse. It's just to say it's understandable that you want to do everything in your power to create safety, to minimize chaos, to help. So it just has to be said that we understand that. But I think we need to, you know, as we're talking about the history, we need to move to a little bit of what purity culture became, because this is where we actually need to identify the harm. So if you're sitting here, you're going, yeah, that's good. Purity culture is good. And let me just say, the heart of purity culture is awesome. But purity is not just sex. Being pure in heart is, you know, Diane, you said this earlier, it's a lifelong quest.
Yes.
Blessed are the pure, for they shall see God. That's an ongoing thing that's not just connected to sex. And in many ways, sex is only one of many parts of what purity is. And so the idea of setting up purity culture was, I think, a beautiful idea, but it was almost exclusively and hyper-focused on sexual purity as the main form and honest, like only form of purity, which creates, in most moments, lopsided understanding.
And even more on virginity.
Yeah.
As purity and virginity became the same word, which is extra biblical because the Bible talks about purity, like you said, of heart and soul, and restoring our purity happens in a moment. And that was a lost message of the purity culture movement.
Yeah.
The idea that it's too late for me. I've already had a sexual experience. It wasn't good in most cases. It wasn't set up to be a good experience, especially for women, but for men as well, who felt wrong about what they had just experienced. That right there set a place for the enemy to get inside mm-hmm. the souls of men and women and just start the whole shame narrative, which he's been using since before the fall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and in addition to that, the ones who did wait for marriage, there was this, and it's so interesting how the enemy is just that idea that he's the father of all lies, but that he's crafty, he's enticing. Mm-hmm. And so it was never said overtly, but like the lies, and maybe it was said overtly in some cases, was that if you wait till marriage, well, then everything is just going to be amazing and perfect and you're going to have this amazing marriage, this incredible sex life. Mm-hmm. But nobody talked about the after. It was just focused on if you had sex before marriage or not. But if you didn't and you waited until marriage, then it was like these promises that everything was going to be just perfect and amazing, which also led to shame. Yes. Because then you have, okay, I'm married, but I still am struggling with lust. Mm-hmm. And or I'm married and our sex life is like really awkward or it's painful or it's and I have nobody to talk to about it because all I ever heard was don't.
Right.
And exactly. So I think it you can see how the enemy worked in those who did have sex before marriage and the immense shame. And I think the messages were so harmful, especially towards women, if that was your story. But it was also harmful for those who did wait because there was no honest conversation about, like you said, a lifelong pursuit. Mm-hmm. Of purity and wholeness and oneness in your marriage. And that doesn't happen just because you had your wedding night and went on your honeymoon.
Mm-hmm. Well, the movement, though, it often responded not with mature formation, but with fear-driven control. And so that's the thing that's really interesting. But that's, I mean, let's be fair. That's all of our tendency.
Yeah.
Is to not look at our situation with our kids and be like, let us respond with mature formation. We usually lead with, get off that thing, you're going to die.
That's
like,
right.
It's fear-driven control.
Consequences.
Is, and control and fear work. They just are very damaging. Not just.
And they're temporary.
They're temporary and they damage. And that's honestly what happened. Again, we are not experts on this. This is our, you know, piecemealed in the sense observation and experience. And so we're just one opinion, right? We're not the authority on this in any way. But as we kind of reflect back and objectively look at this and take out the good and the bad, there was a knee-jerk reaction that became really painful. And it was interesting because it actually became, and again, we have some notes because we want to be really clear. Mm-hmm. In the early 1990s, there was an entire, and I remember this so vividly, an entire subculture around abstinence and sexual purity. Mm-hmm. It was like there were purity rings. You had one.
Oh, of course. Mm-hmm.
You lost it. Your sister lost it. Didn't lose it from virginity.
First, it was a birthstone, and then my dad wanted to be the first one to give us a diamond, which was really beautiful, and I did lose that one.
Yeah. Lost it to me, girl. Anyway, then we had purity balls. There was abstinence rallies, campaigns. There was something called True Love Waits. That's a whole thing.
That was a book.
It was a book. And actually,
it was a conference.
A conference, yeah.
Where people would stay. I just learned this. Yeah. I hadn't. At the time, I wasn't aware of it. You know, we didn't have internet. In many ways, that's a good thing.
Yeah,
because then we were not necessarily influenced by what was happening on other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. West Coast is always a little different than, you know, the Midwest, South. But I heard about these purity balls. I have no idea what that, I never looked up to see really what that was about. But I mean, an alternative to booking a room at the Fairmont in San Francisco is what I assume. Or not going to your senior prom because you didn't want.
Well, and I have to say this is so good. Like, I would want my kids going to a purity ball. Like, I would love that. We're all for
it. Or a whole youth group joining together and saying, because, we are waiting.
Because there is a part, like, this is where we just have to slow down for a second.
We want to let you know about a new offering, a 31-day prayer devotional entitled Sowing a Hidden Seed, Daily Prayers for Your Child's Spiritual Growth. This book was born out of desperation. I didn't know how to lead my kids spiritually, so I started praying, honest, dependent, daily prayers. Jeremiah 29:12 says, "Then you will call on me," God says, and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. If you want to learn more, head to intentionalparents.org. And if you partner with us at $25 a month or more, we'd love to send you a copy as a thank you.
Sex inside of marriage is the most beautiful, helpful place for it to be expressed. Outside of marriage, it is destructive. So when anyone's sitting here going like, well, why is purity matter? Because it's destructive, and sexual specific immorality, as the Bible describes it, is the one and only sin that destroys and affects you and your body. I mean, they all do, but it specifically speaks to the destruction of your own body and soul. Yes. And it's a really interesting thing, because although all sin is sin, certain sins have different consequences. Yes. And we have to recognize, like with our kids, we're trying to save them from a marriage of pain. We're trying to save them from decades of not understanding how this actually works. And I remember when I was talking to my son, and we have ongoing conversations, but when it comes to sex, it's like, man, sex is very similar to a fireplace. It's the best analogy. The Bible uses it for other stuff, but I think especially with sex, it's very powerful. If you have a fireplace, you're familiar with the idea in your home. If you have a fireplace and you light a fire, it's the most beautiful, life-giving, warm, atmosphere-creating, inviting thing in your whole house. Everyone gathers around it. It's beautiful, gives light, warmth, all the good stuff. If you move that fire 2 feet from that particular fireplace to the middle of the living room, it burns down your house in minutes. And that is what sex outside of marriage can do and often does to our soul, even if we're not aware. And so when we talk about this, it's really so much bigger than just sex. It's a soul protection thing for our kids. But I want to just,
I'm saying that because
that's why we want to talk about this.
Yeah. And for me, it's been, I don't know, probably a year or more that we've talked about doing an episode on this. And part of what sparked it for me was looking around and seeing what's happening now. Mm. And I will caveat this with, this could also be the churches we are currently a part of, the exposure we currently have. I'm not saying this is across the board, capital C church everywhere. But as a kind of overcorrection from how much purity culture was an overcorrection in one direction, mm-hmm. the church rarely talks about mm-hmm. it anymore.
Yeah.
And there are some churches that are talking about pornography. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But sex outside of marriage, sex while you're dating or engaged, like, I don't remember the last time I heard a pastor say anything about it. And so it sparked for me of like, how do we need to be talking about this still. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean we don't talk about it anymore, but we're not talking about it because it was done so poorly and so extreme. And now it's like, in many ways, back to what it was
for me
in the sexual revolution, right. where now it is so normalized. It's always been normalized in culture, but now it's very normalized among Christians of it's not that big of a deal. We live together, but we go to church together. Mm-hmm. Oh. It's really just not a big deal anymore. Yeah. And so this kind of started with Brooke and I talking a lot of like, how do we do this well with our kids, communicating to them and teaching them a really good theology of the body, which we're going to talk about, that sex is a really big deal, but how do we not make it purely this moral behavioral thing? And the church is not talking about it. So it is our job as parents. So I'm glad you said that because what we don't want anybody to hear as we talk about the negative things that purity culture did is that we don't believe that it's really important to be sexually pure, because we absolutely do. We just think there's a healthier way to have that ongoing conversation and to give our kids that theology. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
I really want to also make really clear that when it comes to this cultural moment that we're in because of technology, the stats are in and they're staggering, that people, especially young people, are actually by and large having less sex than ever because of pornography. Now, this, again, you might think could be a win, but in every way, it's, if you think about strategy to destroy humankind, that's a pretty neat strategy the enemy came up with. Give somebody something that is a false substitution for real intimacy. Yes. With the physical, biological part without any of the intimacy, mm-hmm. which over time, not initially, but the long game on that is complete and total eradication of humans because you don't procreate. Because, and so, I mean, there's so many levels we could go here, but it's just to say there's this other pendulum where it's actually ironic that even you and I growing up in high school, I remember hearing about friends that would hook up all the time. I remember going to a dance with a girl who was just like a friend. And my buddy's like, are you going to sleep with her tonight? I was like, what? Like, whoa. I was like, what? He's like, I slept with her like 2 weeks ago. I was like, what? You know, my head was just like, and I was a, you know, 16-year-old Christian boy. I was like, what? And I was a virgin when I got married. You know, purity culture, I guess, worked. But I'll say this, like, that was so bizarre to me, but it was also so common for a lot. And that is not, I mean, it's still happening for sure, but it's not as common as it was because of this crazy other problem. And so I want to just highlight maybe a crux of where some of the harm came from and even got perpetuated. And then we want to move to the healing and the hope, because obviously we can't just talk about the history and the harm the whole time, but we have to note it. And this kind of culminated unintentionally. And I, by the way, I want to be so generous. I don't know Joshua Harris, but he wrote a book, I Kissed Dating Goodbye. It is one of the most, I mean, if you are a Christian and you have been around, it is one of the funniest things to say, because it's got so many, I Kissed Dating Goodbye. And for a long time, that was like a great idea. And I'm not going to go into all the details, but I want to be really generous because A, I don't know this person. And I think Jesus calls us to be, Jesus can judge heart and person, but he's a person, he's a child of God. And honestly, from what I have learned, is from as much as you can get from the internet or documentaries, he had a good heart in trying to help with this. Yeah. And it went off in a way that he did not expect. And so I want to be super generous. And Joshua, if you listen to this, respect for you, and please call us, because I'd love to talk to you. I have like 1,000 questions. But I just want to say, like, it was interesting. This book came on the scene, and he was 21. So let's just think about when we were 21. Let's just take prefrontal cortex, not even done yet.
Not even close.
We got married, ironically. That, I don't think that was smart. And he wrote I Kissed Dating Goodbye, and it became, honestly, the voice of a generation.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's a pretty big pressure on him, but also with what ended up happening. And it promoted, essentially, if you're like, what is that book? If you don't know, it promoted courtship over dating and heavily influenced the evangelical purity culture. So it was like a tag on. So this book comes on the scene and it's promoting in a huge way that purity culture. And millions of Christians, as we all know, because we were influenced by it, they adopted its ideas about relationships, sexuality, and marriage, which in part, we would say we agree with a lot of what he wrote in that sense of like purity and saving for marriage and all of that. And some found it really helpful, informative. Some people, honestly, have still been really encouraged by that. And that's not bad.
Actually, I heard Jackie Hill Perry was, I was listening to a podcast, and they were talking about purity culture with Lori Krieg, who her episode may have come out before we just interviewed her.
But, go back and listen to the episode with Lori Krieg.
She was talking about purity culture, and Jackie Hill Perry says, like, I wasn't a Christian when all of that was happening. So I read that book and I thought it sounded fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, here I am, new to faith, and it's like some structure, some guides. Like, I saw nothing harmful with it at the time because she wasn't living it at the height of not just a book, but what's a movement from the church, like you said, Mom, it was coming from kind of everywhere.
Yes.
And so it's so interesting to me to see the difference between benignly reading a book versus being immersed in a movement that is happening in the evangelical church.
Yeah.
And it was a very idealistic movement. So there's a couple cautions here.
That's really good.
This idealism never seems to deliver what it promises.
Yes.
And this was an idealism that I wouldn't even date. I wouldn't have a boyfriend. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have a girlfriend. And it sounded good because of the hookup culture that it was coming out of, and broken hearts. So dating for 3 months, giving yourself sexually to the person, and then he breaks up with you after you thought this was forever. So that was going on constantly, breaking souls in half and damaging terribly. So as new Christians, we were like, yes, this is right. And it sounded so biblical because a lot of things were stretched to apply it. A lot of times when we take a biblical principle and we apply it to our culture right now, we have to be really careful to say this is application, not theology. So it, I think there was a lot of twisting of the actual theology of the body, the theology of marriage, the theology theology of sexuality was missing in the application of, okay, so now we won't even date. Whereas before, when I was a new Christian in high school, nobody hung out, we dated. There was an unspoken rule, you don't date somebody more than three or four times, or you're leading them on if you don't want to be his girlfriend. But we dated in a healthy way where we were getting to know, like, oh, I don't like this kind of thing. Or, oh, I like this kind of thing. You were getting to understand boy-girl relationships in a healthy way. So I kissed dating goodbye forbade that. All of a sudden, now we can't do that.
Well, and why, and before I get back to that, where this hit our life real, and I don't know if you even remember this, but I'll tell you a real story. So we dated for 6 months, and we were 17. Elizabeth, famous words, I can't see myself marrying you.
There was way more to that conversation.
It was basically that. Was it. And then we break up. The point is that we break up. And we dated for 6 months, and I was 17. You were the first girl that had broken up with me. And I was like, oh my gosh, I think I do actually love this girl. Not just because you broke up with me, but because of the fact that I really felt that. Turns out I was right, as FYI. Mm-hmm. But it was really interesting because we had about a 2.5 year gap between when you ended our relationship and some of my life, and we got back together, which is a whole fun story in and of itself. But I remember, we didn't kiss those first 6 months. And there was like Papa Phil too. And he can't represent himself. So I'm going to throw him under the bus. No, I won't throw him under the bus. But I remember, because if I remember right, you guys didn't kiss until you got engaged, right?
Yes, but there was a reason for that.
No, yeah.
There was a reason. So well, what is
the
reason?
Tell the reason. Because it affected me in a negative way. So I would love to know why.
So this is the overreaction that every generation gets into. So watch it. You're probably doing it too.
I'm already doing it, I'm sure.
And get ready. Maybe it will be podcasted to several thousand people.
What are my kids going to podcast about?
Phil's shame when he came to Christ at 22 was his years of
living
sexual promiscuity.
Yeah.
And he never got into drugs. He avoided alcohol. But
that was his life.
And he came to Christ, and all of a sudden his conscience came alive that had been in the back of his mind. He actually said to me once that if his dad, he had so much respect for his dad and love for his dad. If his dad had sat down to him with him and said, Phil, Comer men honor women's bodies and wait till marriage, that he would have, even in the crazy culture, he's convinced that he would have. So an overreaction was by the time we got together and we were dating, he said, the line between affection and passion is so non-existent in me. So I don't want to kiss you. I will not kiss you. I will not tell you I love you. I will not kiss you until I'm ready to ask you to marry me.
Wow.
And it was an honorable thing.
Yeah, of course it
is. Recognizing his own body, that he had violated something in his own body, and he did not want to bring that into our relationship.
Which is so noble.
Yeah. An affectionate kiss. But
let me say, though.
But
so
then,
it's so funny.
Then he took that to the next generation.
So the next generation, we're 20. We go on this trip to Seattle. We stay with some family friends. Obviously, it was an overnight. There were separate rooms. Obviously, we stayed with some friends in their house. But we went on this really beautiful date, and we went to this hill overlooking Seattle. And we were in the car, and it was our first time that we kissed. And I mean, we kissed, girl. That was so fun. And there wasn't touching. It was just kissing. And then it was just so sweet. It was your first kiss.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, girl.
And only first kiss.
Yeah, it better be. Yeah. Anyway, but that said, it was such a cool moment. Now, I remember we came back the next day and we drove home, and we were just so excited to tell you guys, because this was the fun part too, is that you guys were also really invested in our relationship.
Yeah, I don't remember being excited to tell them. I remember we felt like we had to because they thought we weren't kissing.
I think you probably felt
and this
that.
Was
I was like,
such
what are you
a
talking
big
about?
Deal. That yeah. was it was such a big deal.
Well, because it was talked about so much.
So I it felt like I have to tell them because otherwise I'll feel like I'm like lying or like mm-hmm. I'm hiding something.
Mm-hmm. So,
so I don't remember being excited.
Well, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm remembering it better.
Brooke was excited because he wanted more of those.
Yeah, I was like, this, but then, so anyway, we get to the house and then we tell about the trip. And then I think we had just told you that we had kissed. And the whole atmosphere of the room shifted. Because we were in your, I think you guys, we were
in
your room.
In their room.
Yeah, and you guys had a couch. And we're mm-hmm. sitting on the couch, we're telling, and like, everything went from like fine to like, this is not fine. And it, but no one said anything. And then my favorite question.
I'm shocked that nobody said anything. Yeah. I mean,
well, No. I'm saying the atmosphere shifted before anyone said anything. But after it had shifted, what came out was like, you know, your Phil, who's not here, obviously, he would have a great version of this story too. We'll let him defend himself, but essentially like, well, and he asked a good question. What's going to be added to your relationship by kissing right now? And I was like, I don't actually have a good answer for that other than I really want to kiss her and show that love and that affection. And then the statement was like, well, kissing always leads to something. And it's like, agreed, you know? And so we don't think you should kiss. We don't think you need to kiss. We don't think you should kiss. And I was like, I didn't even know this was an option as a 20-year-old that her parents would say we can't kiss. And so I think out of honor for you guys, we said, what did we say? We're like, okay, we're not going to. And so I'm going to truth's coming out for the first time ever on air.
What are you going to say?
No, I just mean like, so we tried to honor that. But basically what it was is like, we just tried not to kiss until we would kiss and then be like, okay, let's just not kiss, you know, because it was almost and actually it's both to actually highlight that Phil was absolutely right. And it was also really challenging to take on someone else's conviction.
Yes.
Because it mm-hmm. wasn't that I actually wasn't worried about sleeping with Elizabeth, but not kissing her. That was like, I don't know if I have that conviction. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't struggling in the sense of like, oh, if I kiss her, then I'm immediately going to have sex with her.
Right.
Because that wasn't my story. I just had never actually unlocked that.
Exactly.
So it was just different for me. And so that was a weird thing to take on the conviction.
Well, I think what you're highlighting, and I think, and Mom, we've talked about this a lot, is that part of what happened with the whole movement was, or at least I'll just speak for myself. I remember hearing a lot, like, you don't have control over yourself. Men especially don't have control. So women, you need to be the control for them. Mm-hmm. And you are always one step away from ruining your life.
Yeah.
That was the like pervasive message I heard all the time, which on one hand, again, like the backlash of the way the pendulum has now swung is like the church doesn't even really use the word sin hardly ever. No. Like, yeah, I think there is
we go to therapy for sin. Instead of
repenting. Exactly. Take heed lest you fall. Like, we need to take sin very seriously and drastically. Yes. That is good.
Yeah.
But what it unintentionally did was train any of the like intuition mm-hmm. and discernment out of yourself. Like, yes. Brooke, what you're highlighting is now looking back and realizing that actually wasn't a personal conviction of mine. And so therefore it didn't stick and it wasn't super meaningful because it was.
No, it was a burden.
It became a rule.
Yeah. And yes. It was like, I'm just trying to honor my future mother and father-in-law, which I want to do, but it's also, it was a yoke that felt so heavy when in reality I look back and go, actually, I wasn't ever in a spot where I was actually concerned or that we ever got to this place where it's like, oh my gosh, we are toying with a line here. Mm-hmm. Like it was, and we also had so many good systems and like practical rules set up and safeguards of like, we're not at the house alone. We're not in a room alone. We're like things that would just practically alleviate some of the just easy ways to fall into unintentionally or accidentally, which I don't think it ever accidentally happens having sex. So just to point out, to finish this book idea, because I want you to talk mm-hmm. about the effects of purity culture, especially the effects that it had on men and women, because I think it was a lot. Mm-hmm. But anyway, let me just tie this up
a little bit with our reality and our situation, what we imposed on you. It is, again, a well-meaning,
totally.
We want to protect you. That then goes too far and leaves out a really essential part of humanness, and that is our own discernment. Mm.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to listen to the warning bells in your mind because your parents were imposing the warning bells and saying, if you go this far, it's too far. Extra biblical again. Every parent is tempted to do it and probably is doing it.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think we need, we weren't at that time as parents, we weren't aware that it was time to pass some of that on to you, to talk openly about why we felt like staying sexually pure before marriage would be the best choice. Instead, we were saying, don't even kiss so that you don't end up that far. Yeah. And that's an extra biblical rule application.
Yeah.
The application, again, almost became the theology. And I think we just have to be really, really careful.
Yeah.
And in every generation. And then we need to make the repairs. We need to be go back to our kids and say, oh, we realize we did this. And we're really sorry. And I hope that you will have the courage to be a little wiser with your own kids. That's really important. Otherwise, if we stay defending the way we apply the theology of the body in marriage and the theology of sexual oneness in marriage, if we're still defending it 20 years later, then there might be a problem.
That is a good
had we just taught you the theology of sexuality and the body and personal responsibility, I have no doubt that you would have had the discernment to know when your space, Elizabeth, for instance, your own body was alerting you to too far.
Yeah.
Don't go further. But we mute that sense of discernment if we impose rules, and especially on our kids who actually do want our approval.
I think that's really good. And I think to the point you made earlier of to put on compassion. I think it's really easy to demonize certain things that were harmful to you that your parents did. I'm thinking specifically of, you know, even the whole purity culture movement. If you are raising younger kids, it's easy to be like, my parents got it completely wrong. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I have a whole new compassion now having teenagers, having a son who's dating, of like, just that we want what's best for our kids. We know that Jesus's way is the way to flourishing. And not because we want to impose rules, but because we want to bring life. Mm-hmm. And so there is those years when your kids are teenagers and young adults, regardless of what the issue is, whether it's sexual purity or finances or driving or... you are constantly having to release control and surrender fear. Mm-hmm. And that's exhausting and it's hard. And so I feel like I have so much compassion now for what you guys were facing, mm-hmm. for dad's story and the fear that he carried because of it. And it doesn't excuse the parts that were harmful, but it does give me an understanding now as a mom in the same stage of we need to be really compassionate, and it makes it a lot easier because you guys are so humble. Mm-hmm. Mom, you are not just able to talk about it. You were like doing most of the research for this episode because you wanted to understand because you didn't experience it like we did.
Yeah,
it was happening around you. It wasn't happening to you. Mm-hmm. And so you've made that extra easy. But I think that idea of putting on compassion and curiosity and understanding, because curiosity leads to understanding, which leads to compassion, is just something we need to never lose, especially when it comes to things we wish our parents had done differently, because there's always reasons why that was happening. And it is a scary time to be raising teenagers and young adults when you no longer have the actual control you used to have or the perceived control that you now recognize you never had.
Well, let me just keep us going here, because I know we could literally talk about this for hours. And I know this to be the case, but as that is a great point, Diane. And I think and this is to finish just out this particular moment, because it was what marked a lot of the purity culture moment, became a voice for a lot of people. It was how it all basically culminated, which is interesting, is the guy who wrote this, Joshua Harris, he spent years listening to critics, and then he reconsidered more and more and more about 2018. He was like reconsidering it. And then he basically in 2018 publicly apologized and asked publishers to stop printing the book. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think just to pause, I know that people have all sorts of feelings, I'm sure, but that takes humility, mm-hmm. FYI. Like that is not just something arrogant people do. Arrogant people just go, no, I'm right. And they just eject. Mm-hmm. So that takes a huge, huge amount of humility. But I think his own life story is just a telling detail of where a lot of people have found themselves. And in 2019, he and his wife actually announced their separation. And even today, he no longer considers himself a Christian. And so, and that's a very public thing, by the way. And he, you know, his story still remains even today to be one of those significant examples of deconstruction influence and the risks sometimes that we have in modern evangelicalism. And it's just a, I think it's a wonderful tale, but story to reflect on and go, wow, like sometimes we can get things really wrong, mm-hmm. even when we're wanting to get them right.
Yeah.
And obviously the question becomes, well, how do we know and all that? I mean, we'll get to that. But I think we have to also talk about that book marked the moment, and then it led to some really interesting like effects that started to play out on women and men both. But mm-hmm. Elizabeth, maybe just mention some of the effects of purity culture. What was mm-hmm. what was propelled because of not only the history that we talked about, but then the purity culture movement. And then you've got, I guess, dating goodbye is like a big, like, raw thing of the generation. Mm-hmm. Give some heads up on that.
I mean, I think how the enemy used it and some great lasting effects that it had while it was happening and then that have lasted was it was all shame-based, all mm-hmm. behavior and shame-based. And basically the constant teaching and idea was that if you have sex before marriage, you have given huge parts of yourself away that you can, not just that you can never get back, but that you can now not give your husband.
Yeah.
And I say husband because the emphasis was heavily put on women in a very different way than it was put on men. Mm-hmm. And I would be curious, Brooke, for you to speak to this too, but what I remember in great detail was a lot of talk around men are visual, women are not, and men have a much higher sexual drive and desire, and it's very hard for them to control themselves. And so girls, you need to dress very modestly because, and again, nope, actually this was said probably way,
I was gonna say, it was said, I remember,
yeah, this wasn't subtle. But essentially that women, and we're women, I'm saying like
girls,
13, yeah. 14, 15, mm-hmm. young girls, mm-hmm. you are responsible for dressing modestly so that your brothers in Christ don't lust after you and you don't cause them to stumble.
Phrases like modest is the hottest. I remember that. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yes. And again, would we say that modesty is
important,
not a great thing? No, we think modesty is a great thing. But I do not want my girls to think that they need to cover up so that so-and-so that they sit next to at youth group is mm-hmm. not thinking lustfully about them. Like that is not their responsibility.
Honor their own bodies.
Now, can we honor the body of Christ and everybody around us and be thoughtful? Absolutely. Yes. I want my girls to be thoughtful, but that is not a burden for them to carry. That is a burden for their brother sitting next to them to carry. So it was very much that women, you are responsible for that. And maybe this was just more the lens I heard things through, but I feel like I heard so much talk around a woman being tainted if she gave herself away. But I don't really remember a lot of talk about a man being tainted if he gave himself away. But Mom, what we were talking about beforehand is you were on a call with somebody yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh my goodness.
Share the story of, because this just paints the picture of I love what you said about, and now I'm going to forget exactly how you worded it, but about how the theology piece that we missed the, what did you say? That we like have to be so careful to not teach bad theology
mm-hmm. As application.
Yes.
Or
yes,
application and theology are two different things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Need to be separated.
Yeah.
So this woman gave me permission to share this, though I won't share her name. She was grew up as a Christian, and she went to Christian school. In eighth grade, one of her teachers filled a bowl, a clear glass bowl, with water. And there was a bunch of stuff on the table around it, and the whole class gathered around. Excuse me. And they each had to pour something into the bowl of water. So it was ketchup and dirt and yucky stuff.
Yeah.
They had no idea what this was about. This wasn't like sex education, because Christian schools did not do sex education.
Which is so tragic. Dumb. So dumb.
And the teacher, they were all done with this yuck experiment. And the teacher said to these eighth graders, this is what you will give your husband or your wife, but I think mostly the girls heard it, your husband or your wife, if you have sex with somebody else before marriage. This
is what you'll give them.
You will bring that into your marriage. Mm.
That's in eighth grade.
Horrific.
Yeah, it is.
And then the second one,
would you say you experienced?
Uh-huh.
She told me a different teacher, same school, had a piece of paper and had them all tear pieces off the piece of paper. So every kid in the class was holding this little fragment of a piece of paper. And that teacher explained that while a pure person, meaning a virgin, mm-hmm. okay, very narrow definition of purity, a virgin, would be able to give this whole white piece of paper mm-hmm. to their husband or wife on their honeymoon. But the rest of you, if you weren't pure, were only going to give this little scrap. Mm-hmm. And you said that happened in youth group.
That was done in youth group. Yeah. And I remember it.
I never knew.
I remember it also said that all those torn off pieces, you've given it to somebody else forever. They have a part of you forever. You can never get that part of you back. Yes. That was said a lot. Yes. And to your point of the theology piece of application and theology, we were also talking before, and I was saying that's so, first of all, anti the gospel, mm-hmm. that we have been washed clean and pure,
mm-hmm.
white as snow.
Yep.
And that what true repentance and forgiveness actually does to us, washes us clean.
Completely.
Now again, doesn't mean that we don't have consequences for sin. The Bible's really clear about that, and consequences for sexual sin. But that is total false theology, that you're handing this dirty bowl.
Yes.
That can never be clean
again.
Can
never be redone.
And
there are consequences, Elizabeth, but God is so gracious that he even mitigates the consequences.
Yes.
It's not like a forever consequence.
Yes.
It's maybe sometimes momentary in order to get our attention to realize, oops.
Can I say also, though, how many people we talk to in our age? I talk to many of them one-on-one. The amount of people that still don't understand truly in their heart, in their body, in their soul, in their spirit, what grace actually is staggering. So can I just say to anybody listening that's hearing this, so important, I am still not comfortable with the amount of grace that God gives me and other sinners. It is still absolutely staggering and unfair, and I don't think I feel like it's unfair to God. Mm-hmm. And that is the gospel. That is what makes it so amazing. Is that it's completely imbalanced. It's completely, in a sense, unfair that Jesus would literally die so that we could mm-hmm. be pure, so that we could have relationship. And I think it's important for anyone to hear, like, Jesus is the hose that cleans that bowl out and makes it completely clean in moments.
Yes.
And I understand that you are sitting here and you have the psychology and you had that experience and you were in college and you made that decision, or you slept with your boyfriend or girlfriend before and you just can't get over it. And I understand that you can't get over it, but I don't think it's about you getting over it as much as it's about you understanding that even if you don't understand, grace is there for you and you don't have to fully understand it to receive it. Yeah. And you don't even have to fully understand it for it to be true and for it to be happening and for it to already be healing. And so the enemy would love to just keep you stuck in the lie that it's not really as good as it sounds. It's not really as good. And to anyone that's listening that it's like, I'm having a hard time in my sex life because I bring shame into every time we interact with one another, that's a lie that needs to be dealt with as serious as it is. And it needs to be something that you confess as like, God, I'm not trusting you and help me. And my favorite story in the scriptures, I love it. Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief. Like, I know that many people believe in grace. They believe in Jesus, but there's parts of you that haven't yet been able to grasp that. So just start asking God for it. Yeah. I believe, but help my unbelief. Mm-hmm. Help my doubt of grace being as real as it feels. And so that.
And confession, confess that lack of application of grace in this area of your life to somebody you trust who can keep you accountable and keep reminding you, you do remember, right? Mm-hmm. This is washed completely clean.
Well, and I think too, there's so many in the exact place you just talked about where they have a past that they feel so much shame about. But another thing that happened with all of this is like we already talked about, the ones who did save themselves for marriage. And then now they feel so much shame around sex because they were taught for so long, it's dirty, it's bad, it's dirty, it's bad, it's going to ruin your life. Mm. But now it's not anymore. Yeah. But we feel in our body what we experienced for years growing up, that it's bad, it's bad, it's bad. I need to be scared of myself. For women, I need to be scared of men and their desires.
Yeah.
I need to be scared of my own desires. And that's a huge miss. We did not teach a theology of the body and what happens in a body, that sexual desire itself is a God-given good thing. And that was not taught. And so I would say for anyone listening in that case where you're like, I did save myself, but sex is still super hard and I just feel like pleasure is bad. And I think those are the moments when we need to like renounce the work of the enemy and not only speak the truth over our marriage and our intimacy, but also like say, no, I'm not going to believe the dark lies of the enemy that aren't true. Right. God, would you help my body heal from the lies that it still believes are true? And that was just, and again, all this was unintended. Nobody set out for that to be what it ended up creating. But I think the saddest thing for me that still just lives on so strong is that what it created was we need to hide all of it. We can't talk about, as Christians, we can't talk about sex. We can only talk about like maybe we can touch on pornography, the big like blatant things that we know are bad, but we can't actually like tell somebody if we're struggling. We can't actually tell somebody if we're looking at pornography. It's just everything had to go hidden. Because there was so much shame around you've now ruined your life forever. Yeah. You are now dirty forever. Right. And I think that is what has lingered probably stronger than anything else. Wow. And I think led to so much of what we're seeing of, I mean, the stats on Christians who regularly look at pornography, it's not distinguishable between Christians and non-Christians. Yeah. The stats are just... There's it's maybe non-Christians might believe there's nothing wrong with it and Christians would believe there is something wrong with it, but the percentage of use is very similar. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, it'd be so interesting. People way smarter than us, I'm sure, have made some of these connections of what it did, especially for the rise of pornography for Christians. Yeah. Because it left so many men of like, okay, well, I had all this promise to me that I was going to get married and all of my desires were going to be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. Again, back to what we've talked about with we linked purity and sex.
Virginity.
They were unanimously the same thing.
Yeah.
And so if I just waited and I was a virgin when I got married, then I was not going to struggle with purity or lustful thoughts.
Right.
All of my desires were going to be met with my wife, who somehow has the magic ability to meet all of those desires, which didn't happen, which led so many men and women to use pornography because we have all of these misplaced desires and these false promises.
Well, and you said something earlier about, you know, the men's sex drives being high, but it's this really unique moment in history where, I mean, in a lot of our intentional fatherhood stuff, a lot of the questions that we'll get is like, what do I do when my wife's sex drive is so much higher than mine? And what's interesting about that is, again, it's a distortion of what pornography is doing. so many men use pornography to the point where their sex drive is satiated somewhere else. Things like impotence become a problem because of the overuse of technology, and they're used to a digital release versus an actual physical one. So the physical doesn't actually turn them on as much as a digital one. And then the other backside weakness is then women are using pornography and they're more actually sexually inclined or curious than before. And so all to say, I don't think it's lopsided for a wife or a husband to have a higher structure. Like, there's nothing weird or wrong. Everyone's biology is different. Everyone's marriage is different. Everyone's needs are different. It's just to simply say the rise in all of this is really very interesting because there are so many ways in which this has become challenging and distorted. And that's not to say if, like, you're a spouse and you're a wife that has a higher sex drive, there's nothing wrong with it. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like, the point of it, we get this question a lot, like, the point, whether you're a husband with a higher sex drive or a wife with a higher sex drive, the answer is the same. Your job is to serve and love one another. That means, husband, if you have a higher sex drive, you're not going to probably have as much sex as you want. And wife, you're probably going to have a little more than you want. But the reverse is true. Wife, you're probably not going to have as much sex as you want. And husband, you're going to have more than you want. And the point isn't to say no or yes, or this person gets to decide. It's to meet each other and serve each other. Mm-hmm. All that said, I just think to name that that is another way in which this has been really distorted. And what you're highlighting is so important because that has made it into so many homes. And we need to move, we need to talk about, you know, the hope. But is there anything else? You know, obviously we've been talking about the history, some of the harm, but I'd love to talk about some of the hope.
One very brief added thought is you the two of you recorded a few episodes on sexuality and marriage.
Yeah, sex and marriage. Yeah.
And an accidental observation that Phil and I have made over the years is when a couple comes to us, they've been married 20, 25 years, they're struggling in their marriage, they're feeling very distant from each other, they're feeling kind of like roommates, and Phil, who has the audacity to say anything, I could probably never bring it up, something so personal, would always ask, well, how's your sex life? And 100% of the time, we got these almost scared looking faces because it was non-existent. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are not old people who supposedly there is a point in your life where that's not going to happen anymore. Mm-hmm. These are young, vibrant, healthy individuals who are trying to do marriage without sex. And I just think
so scary.
That is so, I don't know. Purity culture maybe has invaded even in that area to have the idea that you can have a genuine love relationship and oneness without any form of sexuality is very naive to think that this is true. Yeah. And that has to be part of this theology of sexuality that we teach our kids, that this is going to be, this is what will bring you together when everything is pulling you apart. Sex is not separated from your relationship. But I do remember a man in the middle of tragic ending of his marriage, which was entirely his own fault, but him kind of just like crying out and saying, oh, but with my wife, to have sex with my wife, she required that I climb Mount Everest. So she had this, probably from purity culture, this idealized view of sex that it's always going to be just so romantic. Instead of just, sometimes it's just physically coming together because it's fantastic and you need it. Yeah. And you both need it. That has to be included. We didn't talk about that in purity culture. But we have to, you have to. With
purity,
your teenagers.
Purity
now.
Culture didn't, but you and Dad did.
We did.
We were just on what's the podcast? Oh, Kingdom Sexuality. And somehow that came up.
Yeah.
And I was saying, for all the harm purity culture did, and yes, it affected me and all that, I do feel like that's something that somehow along the way you very much helped us understand the importance of it within marriage. And so I feel like I got messages that so many didn't because you guys were talking about it as well. And I think there were so many that so many parents who were like, my parents never talked to me about it. I have no idea how to talk to my kids about it. But the youth group's doing this series on, they're reading I Kissed Dating Goodbye, so I don't need to talk about it. And so thankfully, I feel like I got the harmful messages, but I also got a lot of intentionality of you guys giving me that framework, which for us in our marriage, and we talked about it on that podcast, has been helpful given all of my health stuff. It would be very easy to be like, well, this is just how our marriage has to be. But instead for me to have the framework that, no, this is still really important for us to keep this alive in our marriage, even if our story looks different and it's not as easy.
Yeah.
So I'm really thankful that that's something you guys talked about, and it is just a part of my framework and view, not something I had to learn later.
So make sure you pass that on to your kids.
Yeah.
And all the warnings that this is, that they carry this into marriage.
But to anybody who's sitting here going like, but why, you know, why can you not have a marriage without sex? The Bible says this directly. Do not basically deny one another and only deny one another, or don't have sexual intimacy for an agreed upon amount of time. And the only real reason it gave was for fasting.
Yeah.
And prayer.
And fasting and prayer. Mm-hmm. And the point being that that implies a lot of things, including, girls, let me finish. I know both of you are, I see both of you chomping at the bit. Let me just finish.
Another part of that verse.
Let me just finish. Chill out. OCD, be done with. Just give me a second. All to say that that is a very important highlight that I want to make, that it implies that this is a regular common thing, which means that there's something for us to learn that God is trying to communicate with us in that, which is the regularity of sexual intimacy is something that keeps your marriage alive. And therefore, sometimes it's the thing and the only thing that can keep your marriage alive in really hard seasons. It was it's a difference between you and a roommate. So it's just to say, That's a part of it. Okay, go. Ladies, you're both about to jump on me.
I'm just going to snicker a little bit because I read that passage and I think, oh yeah, who's actually going to say, oh, I'm praying.
Sweetheart, so, I'm not able to. Know. Actually, you've never done that, but maybe I'll do that to you sometime. Like, sweetheart, I'm so sorry. You'd be like, awesome.
Sounds great. I'll pray with
you. That's not funny. That's not funny. This is a sore spot for me. Keep going.
No, but... isn't there a part of that verse that says that highlights, but not for too long lest you be tempted?
Yes, that's what it come together often lest you're tempted.
But then I was also thinking of this is easy to forget too. Marriage is just an earthly picture of our relationship with Christ. Yeah. We are the bride of Christ. Marriage is just literally to show us the picture of the closeness and the intimacy and the oneness that is possible in our relationship with God, the covenant, the commitment, that I'm not going anywhere. And you think about that even in our own faith and our own relationship with God. When we have these long periods of distance where we are not truly allowing God to intimately know us, because it's a relationship. It is a two-way street. It is us. He knows everything, but it's us coming to him and bearing our souls to him, like being naked and unashamed before him. We grow distant from God. We drift from God. We try to control things on our own. We try to just live a life of morality versus relationship when we are not having a constant coming together with God and revealing ourselves to God. And so I think that can't be lost either, that there is, just like it is important in our own marriage, it's also to show us how important that type of knowing is between us and God.
Yeah.
And there's a whole book of the Bible.
Song of Solomon,
Song of Solomon, which, today's scholars say these are actual stories. This is not, don't take this too allegorical. It is a husband and wife. It's just about sexual love. I think that's a too far of a swing because it's also allegorical.
Yeah.
It's also maybe not allegorical, maybe metaphorical. The idea that we have passion for God, that we want him, that we feel like we can't do without him, that we crave his presence. I mean, without that, we become these fill-in-the-blank, legalistic, rigid kind people, of Christians.
Yeah.
And
and
generally speaking, that's not a faith that we can pass on to our kids, because who wants that kind of faith?
But let me, but just to say, like, so what is kind of the hope here? And
yeah.
And really, because I hope, our hope, honestly, is that this conversation gives you a lot to think about, gives you a lot to process, and the Spirit is highlighting the things that we need to. But for those who are like, okay, how do we not repeat this? And how, mm-hmm. and how do we actually even truly for ourselves heal? And I think this is going to be for you if you need healing, or for you to pass mm-hmm. on to your kids and to be aware of. And again, if this isn't something that's even on your radar, or your kids are young, just let this be something that you know is going to be happening. Because even for Elizabeth and I right now in our moment, we are trying to figure out the pendulum, because we don't mm-hmm. want to do it. There were so many good things that you and Phil helped us with. And then there was a half of it where we're like, mm-hmm. nope, we don't want to yes. do that. But we also don't know, like, well, what's too far? What's too, so we're even truly trying to figure that out too. Mm-hmm. And so it's just to say, like, it is not an exact science. It is a dance. It's back and forth. It's learning. It's doing it wrong before you figure out how to do it right. But can I just encourage you, do something, do something. And so three quick, and I'm going to say quick because I don't think they need mm-hmm. to be long, but quick takeaways for you. The first thing we must do for you to understand this, but also for you to give your kids, you have to give your kids a theology of the body, not just a list of rules. Mm-hmm. This is going to be so important for you to heal. Most of you are responding. Purity culture was a list of rules, do's and don'ts, black and white, idealism. And that's just not how life works. That is not how Jesus works. And the theology is important. And you have to teach your children things like, and feel free to add, ladies, but your body's good. Like you already said this, Elizabeth, you said that great. Your body's good. Desire is good. Desire is good. It is good to have that desire. It's God-given. Attraction is normal. Mm-hmm. It's good. Sexuality is powerful. We talked about the fireplace analogy. Mm-hmm. Teach them that. Use that analogy. Like, kids, mm-hmm. you want to see a cool thing? Dad just burned the house down, because it's really practical. And then also that intimacy is sacred. It's between mm-hmm. two. And so when they understand God's design for our kids, but any kid in general, when you explain the why, a lot mm-hmm. of the curiosity is solved, but also the part of them that's like, well, why? I know this happens a lot with our sons in high school. Anytime he brings a story home to me about a friend that's, or just something he saw, I'm constantly trying to help him see like the why behind it, mm-hmm. so he can understand why certain things are actually mm-hmm. destructive. And, you know, he was telling me a story of a situation, somebody at his work, and it was just so interesting to me because I was trying to explain to him, like, this is why, mm-hmm. here's the why of why you don't want to dabble into, whether it was, I don't know, drinking alcohol, or smoking, I can't remember the deal. But I was like, look at, you see the pattern? Like, do you see how much more challenging it is now for this person? And just answering the why, like, this is why we say no to these things. It's the same with sexuality. It's the same with that. Teach them a theology. It's not just a list of rules. There's beauty there. Any thoughts on that before we go to the next one? Yes.
I would add just one. Teach them that the body is good, you said.
Yeah.
But the whole world is teaching that only certain bodies are good. Mm. The ones who are voluptuous and skinny, who don't have wrinkles, whose stomach hasn't been, you know, stretched out 3 feet and gone back 3 or 4 times. I think it's really important that we teach our kids that the body is good no matter what it looks like at any given time.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, we have only skinny, perfectly in shape young people can experience great
that's
sex.
And we actually have talked about that, and we will keep talking about that. And that is actually on complete topic in a different, and it's its own. I mean, that should be our own. We should have a whole episode. Mm. We've had some of that.
We should do an episode on that.
Men and women need to know that.
Oh, both, yeah.
But I think with that, one thing that's really important, especially as your kids walk through puberty, like from early stages all the way through, puberty is just wild in general, scary in some senses to a lot of kids. And I think maybe especially to Christian kids, because their body is waking up and these new sensations are happening, which feel foreign and funny to them. And so that idea of, you know, we talk about this a lot. There's so many people doing good work on this right now. It's not just one big conversation. It's a series of thousands of mini conversations. Yeah. But the idea is they're getting older and they understand what sex is and their body begins to change, that you are a source of if they're not bringing the conversation to you, you're constantly cracking the door, inviting the conversation to happen. As their body is changing to normalize what is happening to you is not weird. It is not bad. There's nothing wrong with you. You are not the only one. Mm-hmm. The funny like feeling you have because you just saw somebody kiss or you just, you're doing nothing wrong. The fact mm-hmm. that you're thinking
call
about
it a funny
sex.
Feeling, that's great.
No, but I mean like that, that's what they call it when they're
I'm going to start saying 10
and 11.
Sweetie, I have a funny have feeling.
When
funny
the girls feeling. Say, when the little say, ew.
I kissed her on the cheek this morning. Like, ugh. I'm like, guys.
But I remember with one of our kids when like thoughts would start to pop in their mind uh-huh. that they felt like were bad, like sexual thoughts. And getting the chance to, and this is the beautiful redemptive piece when we can learn from the past, when we can heal in our own stories, and we get to do something different with our kids, to get to say to that kid, hey, and this kid was like anxious about like, I think I'm bad because I just thought about that. Mm-hmm. But to be able to say, hey, you know, you are totally normal that mm-hmm. that thought came into your mind. That desire is not a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with it. Now, you do need to take control of those thoughts, not let them run rampant. Mm-hmm. And you're in a unique time where that it's going to be a while before anything happens. But like curiosity, to get to just yeah. normalize, you're not bad because you feel like this or you're curious or you, yeah.
yes.
you know.
Yes.
And I think that's part of teaching them a theology of the body. It's not just what does the Bible teach about sex and what do the Greek and Hebrew words mean? It's this is the process your body is going to go through. This is what's yeah. developmentally happening yeah. in your brain.
Yeah.
They need to know that stuff.
Yeah. Yes.
So we got to give them like the theology. And I couldn't agree more that what you're saying is so helpful. And so first, give them theology, not just as a rule. Second, give them grace that is bigger than their failure. This is mm-hmm. what I think so many people, Elizabeth, you addressed this really well earlier, but we have to recognize that one of the deepest, and I could not, this is so important, I see this completely, that one of the deepest wounds from purity culture is that belief that one mistake was going to permanently mm-hmm. damage you yeah. and permanently damage your future. Mm-hmm. And the real argument about that is the gospel. The gospel says completely yes. otherwise.
Yes.
And so your children need to know that you are not your worst decision. If yes. you made a really bad decision, you're yes. not the worst decision. Yes. You're not less valuable because of sexual sin. You're not disqualified from intimacy or marriage because mm-hmm. this happened. There's a path mm-hmm. home, and not only to your home, but to God especially. And maybe, and I think this is especially important for you to give your kids, but I think there's a lot of people listening that need to hear this. You are not, grace is bigger uh-huh. than your failure.
Yes.
You have grace. And these are not things that have, maybe you feel like they've defined you, but they actually, in true story, don't. And so this Christian story has never been about perfect people avoiding mistakes. Oh. It's about Savior's
story. It is a gospel of failure.
Preach, yes. Mom. You put it, something about yes. this in the notes, and I
yes,
read it.
Yes, I did.
And I told Brooke this morning, I was like,
just shooting off
yes,
all these
no,
emails
you need to
you.
Say, you need to say it.
So
though.
Ours is a gospel of failure. That's yeah. how we actually come to the yes. cross.
Yeah.
That's why the cross was necessary.
Yes.
We cannot possibly live up to the morality found in the scriptures. No, I cannot.
None of us.
You cannot. Nobody can. And I'm not just talking about sexual morality, but be angry and do not sin. Who has not violated that?
Yeah, exactly.
What parent has not? What married couple has okay. been angry at each other and not sinned in the process? We can't live it up to the morality found in the scriptures, let alone all the added restrictions like don't dare kiss because it might lead that we put on each other in order to avoid sin. Those are yeah. dangerous restrictions. Mm-hmm. We actually come to Christ for forgiveness, and so must our kids. That is when their faith will become real.
Yes.
Most likely, and I hate to say this sitting across from two lovely parents, most likely when they are deep disappointment to themselves mm-hmm. and they blow it and they make a mistake of some sort and all of a sudden they feel that, it's like Paul on the road to Damascus, that light, blinding light of mm-hmm. conviction, at that point is when they know they need a savior. Mm, and
totally.
All of a sudden he becomes indispensable. Before that, they're just good kids. But at that point of their sense of, oh my gosh, what did I just do? This is when the cross becomes paramount and will guide the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And yet we as parents, understandably, I totally did this, live in fear of that failure. Mm-hmm. And partly we're afraid that there are going to be lifelong consequences, like a child born or pregnancy, unwanted pregnancy or a car wreck because they were drinking and driving. I mean, of course, we're afraid of that. But I think we should not be so afraid of our kids' failures because Jesus is not afraid of our failures.
I know he made a way for it actually to account for it. And I think we're always the ones that are surprised when we're not perfect. And he's like, I knew that from the beginning. That's why we set it up this way.
And what one of us cannot date our actual passion and, you know, we talk about raising passionate Jesus followers, not just moral Jesus followers. But who of us cannot date our first sense of passion for Jesus to some failure on my part? That's my whole story.
Sure.
I think we have to realize that. The good news is not come to Jesus to be saved from the effects of sin. The good news is that when we stumble, and we will, and when we sin, and we do, we turn towards God.
Yes.
And we turn towards this loving embrace of a Father we didn't even, we heard about, but we didn't actually know deep in our souls. And we're immediately embraced, we're immediately forgiven. That yucky bowl in the classroom is washed.
Went through the dishwasher. Yeah.
And made gorgeous.
Yeah.
That is the Savior that we fall in love with and that we stay in love with. And I look back to, I don't know Joshua Harris's story, but I know he was raised in a Christian home. His parents were some of the forerunners of the homeschool movement. The most, you know, they did conferences and things like that back in the day. But my guess is some of his fame came before he had fallen in love with the Savior who embraced him in his own sinfulness. And therefore, that's a faith that is so disappointing.
Oh, yeah.
And honestly, anytime we monetize something, you make money, you get famous. In purity culture was monetized.
Yeah.
We should always be really suspicious at that point in time. Is there something evil now backing this to the point of fame? But my guess is that maybe he didn't understand the love of the Savior and didn't understand his grace before he got famous. And maybe, that's dangerous.
Maybe,
that's just dangerous.
And it's hard to know, but I also think that you're probably not, you're not far off. But that was a great way to sum, give them grace that's bigger than their failure. And that's that, give them that gift. And last, again, I think we could keep going, but just a last kind of idea for you to give your kids and for yourself, give them wisdom instead of formulas. Purity culture, the problem was that it kept promising certainty. Like, do these things, and you said this, Elizabeth, do these things and your life is going to turn out well. That's just not how life really works. And so that's the problem. Elizabeth and I are in the throes of suffering with health stuff in ways that I'm going like, Job makes a lot of sense to me right now, the story of Job. It's like, well, I'm trying to do the right thing. I don't think I'm doing anything wrong. Yet all of these things are constantly not going right. In fact, they're getting worse. And life does not work in the way of, if you do this, then this happens. It's wisdom. It's back and forth. And so, I mean, we do this with our kids a lot. Like, the consequence about how, like, even as your kids get older, most of the discipline when they get older is the consequence of their own decision making. And it's interesting because that is truly the case. Like, hey, kids, choices have consequences. And ironically, sex especially, but not just sex, there's different consequences that are larger and smaller depending upon what you do. And you know, driving a car, getting a speeding ticket, that's one consequence. Drinking and driving, that's another. Hitting somebody with your car and killing a person, that's another. And recognizing that these choices are yours to make and helping them feel confident in their decisions. And
giving them, helping them grow in wisdom and discernment. And Sally talked a lot about this on the episode we did, Mom, with her could maybe link that in the show notes, but that, and she described it as we all have the Imago Dei in us. Mm-hmm. And I think just helping as from a very young age, but especially as they are teenagers and it's a unique time where their prefrontal cortex is not developed. So it's harder for them to sometimes access that wisdom and discernment. But our goal is to raise really wise and discerning mm-hmm. followers of Jesus, to be able to spot a movement like purity mm-hmm. culture or, mm-hmm. or to have a sense of like, when I feel a check in my spirit, like to ask, is that the Holy Spirit? Yeah. Is that God trying yeah. to lead me in a way of wisdom and discernment? And to teach them that doesn't just come because we gave them a set of rules and we are the wise mm-hmm. sages and they just need to listen, but to slowly help them develop mm-hmm. their own discernment and wisdom with the Holy Spirit mm-hmm. to be able to make choices like who they're going to marry and what job path they feel like yeah. God is leading them to, and mm-hmm. how they're supposed to parent their kids. And that is our goal. Mm-hmm. And a list of rules with promised outcomes does not create that. In fact, it actually down the road, and this is the most devastating thing, we see it all the time, is it creates this, that works until it doesn't. It works until something hard happens in your life that reframe. You didn't cause,
yeah.
that you can't reframe, whether it's something that was done to you by somebody else or a health diagnosis or, and mm-hmm. all of that theology, all of that belief just shatters in an mm-hmm. instant because it wasn't built. It was built on sand. It wasn't built on a firm foundation because it wasn't built on actual truth that we are a suffering people. We suffer with Christ. We will this side of heaven. And, but we have the hope of Jesus. We have the Holy Spirit. We have discernment to know how to navigate a life that is hard, a sex life that is imperfect and will remain mm-hmm. imperfect forever until heaven when there is no marriage or sex.
I don't have to talk to God about that.
Even to remind them that this longing that we feel inside, no matter what the longing is focused on in the moment, really is a longing for home in yes. the sense of the new heaven and the new earth where the tears are wiped away, where all things are made bright, where the longing is finally satisfied. Yeah. It will never be, it won't be satisfied in a perfect marriage. There isn't one for one thing.
Perfect marriage.
And then what happens when somebody changes in their marriage and it's disappointing? That longing is for Christ. It is for a day that is yet to come.
So, yeah.
And will never be fully satisfied until that day comes.
Well, share this episode with family, with friends. Thank you for being so present. I know this is a longer conversation, but the history, the harm, and the hope, purity culture, it wasn't all bad, but it wasn't all good. And we want to seek understanding and grace in all of it. So come back next week, and thank you guys for listening today.